You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Here they are, your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, Steve, Jay, Rebecca, Bob, and Evan.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. And we are live from the Australian Skeptics National Convention in 2014. Joining me, as always, is Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Evan Bernstein.
Hello, Australia.
And we have a special guest rogue with us, George Robb.
Hi.
Yay.
All right, well, this show that we're recording is going to air on December 13th. So, Rebecca, you're going to tell us what happened in this day.
Slightly depressing. On this date in 1972, man walked on the moon for the very last time. Gene Cernan and Jack Schmidt were the last two people to have the honor. They were part of the Apollo 17 mission. Apparently, there was a 12-day mission. Cernan reported later that he scratched his daughter's initials into the rock, which are probably still there, considering conditions on the moon. But yeah, nobody has been back to check, unfortunately.
Right.
So, kind of depressing.
What's that, 42 years?
Sure.
I bet you nobody at the time would have thought it would have taken 42 years, and we're still really nowhere near getting back to the moon. There's no plans at the moment.
Yeah, nothing.
Yeah. So that is sad. That's amazing. I mean, obviously we all remember the Apollo mission very fondly when we were kids, and I mean, the idea that we've gone on pretty much our whole lives. So, but Jay, you're going to tell us about Lunar Mission 1. So we're going to Kickstarter our way back to the moon, apparently.
Yeah, I was doing a little reading about past moon missions just to kind of whet my appetite for this. So the first manned moon mission was Apollo 11 with Neil Armstrong, Michael Collins, Buzz Aldrin, and that was in 1969. And as Rebecca said, the last trip to the moon was in 1972, Apollo 17. There has been a total of 12 men who landed on the moon at over six different missions. I tried to get a number of all of the probes that were sent to the moon. And I think it's in the teens. Mm-hmm. There's been quite a bit. There's lots of missions smack things into the moon to do some analysis. So I think this Kickstarter is very interesting. So listen to this. These guys want to send an unmanned robotic landing module to the south pole of the moon. And it's a previously unexplored area. And the Kickstarter ends on December 18th. They have, as of this morning, just over 4,600 backers and over $500,000 U.S. dollars. And their goal is to get $1 million.
Yeah.
What sort of rewards do you get for that?
Frequent flyer miles.
Yeah, it's.
I want my initials scratched into the lunar surface.
Yeah. How much for a moon rock? You going to bring back any moon rocks?
They want to drill down 20 meters, and 20 meters is 10 times deeper than any other previous mission that did any drilling. And they're actually hoping that they can get down to 100 meters, which is really deep. That would be fantastic if they could do it. This will allow them to study lunar rock that is, guess how old the lunar rock is at that depth?
4 billion years.
4.5 billion years old.
4.5 good guess. Billion.
Did you know that?
Yeah.
You know it now.
So here's what they want to do. They want to study the geologic composition of the moon. They want to learn more about the relationship between the moon and the Earth. They want to learn more about the effects of asteroid bombardment on the moon. They want to learn more about the early solar system, the formation of the Earth and moon, and hopefully the condition that initiated life on Earth. Now, out of all of those, I think that last one is stretching it. But I think they're using that as a way to sell the Kickstarter.
Yeah.
They're also, now here's another half of the mission. I'll answer Rebecca's question. So they're leaving time capsules on the moon, so they're going to dig the hole. And then they're going. You with me, Bob?
I'm with you.
Okay, they're going to drop these time capsules into the hole that they drill, and one of them is going to be for all the people that contributed to the Kickstarter. And they're going to be able to put anything they want on there, you know, digitally, of course.
Is it going to be shaped like an obelisk?
It would be pretty badass.
That would be badass.
But the other thing that they're going to do is they're going to catalog, you know, human history and all sorts of information about being a human and life on Earth and everything, and that's in the other time capsule.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Yeah. So Jay, is it like a hard drive? What kind of digital thing are they putting in there? What is
I looked specifically for that. I couldn't find it. It is okay. Going to be digital, of course, because there's going to be thousands of people's contributions. But I don't know about, you know, it could be a thumb drive at this point.
Yeah, but is it going to be like Mac formatted or PC? Because I saw Independence Day, and it seems like that could get us in trouble. I don't know. Aliens or Mac, I think, right? Yeah.
You think aliens are Mac over PC?
That's what happened in Independence Day, right? He went up there and uploaded the virus using his, PowerBook, I think. It's been a while. Maybe Independence Day 2, which is coming out soon, is going to clear all that up.
Is it?
Yeah, well, not soon. I think they just started.
So David Iron, who founded Lunar Missions Limited, he's been working on the concept for 7 years, and he said that they've been working on creating the science case for it, you know, to see if it's feasible, identifying the instruments that they're going to need, and all the technology that will need to be created or included in on the probe. And they're engaging hundreds of scientists and experts to help bring the project to life. So apparently all that has been done now, and they're at the stage now where they're getting it on its feet. Mm-hmm. Now, one disappointing fact I really didn't like is they think maybe they're going to be able to send it up in 10 years. And they said about 10 years.
Yeah,
which means 20 years.
Yeah, at best.
Never.
Right. But this is unmanned mission to the moon, not a manned mission.
No, it's definitely unmanned.
Yeah. So we're still, I mean, there's always talk with NASA and others about when are we going to get people on the moon again, but there really isn't any concrete timetable at this point in time, which, yeah. And, you know, and already they're talking about Mars. This is, you know, a debate I know we've touched on that's been going on for decades, to go to the moon or to go to Mars. And Isaac Asimov wrote a very compelling essay about it, yep. You know, where he said that essentially if we flesh out the infrastructure between the Earth and the moon, you know, have a base on the moon, have stations in orbit that can get you to the moon, it'll be a lot easier to sustain a mission, like a permanent mission to Mars.
I mean, sure. It does seem, though, that we're going to have to send a lot more unmanned missions to the moon before there's even any point to sending people to the moon.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, and there are, you know, unmanned missions to the moon still ongoing. But, yeah, I agree. And I think we were moving away from the so-called flags and footprints missions, you know, where you send somebody there, they plant the flag, they walk around, and they come home. And transitioning to permanent infrastructure.
Yeah.
You know, again, I thought we should have been 20 years ago, you know, and that's where I really think we need to start transitioning. But I do wonder also, like, how much Kickstarter public funding is going to be playing in future space exploration.
Well, it's moving into the private sector. I mean, we have companies that are not governments that are, frankly, doing a much better job at developing technology and...
I don't know if I would say developing the technology. NASA is actually really good at developing the technology. Then the private industry comes in afterwards and uses it for tourism, exploration, and other...
I don't know if I agree with that. I mean, Dragon V2 is their technology, right?
Yeah, but it's riding on the coattails of NASA, which is fine. That's the whole point. You know, no company can invest the hundreds of billions it would take before a technology would become profitable or viable. You need governments to do that, but then you need to hand it over to private industry to take it from there, and then it really explodes. So we're right in that transition. Yeah. And NASA can go on to other things, trying to explore deep space or whatever.
Steve, I'm curious, though, how much of NASA technology is actually out there and available to build upon, though?
You think they're keeping it to themselves?
So, I mean, certain aspects of it, maybe.
I don't think so. I think they're working close. They're not. They're working closely with the private industry. The technology is open.
Yeah, they're funding. Good. They're funding Virgin and SpaceX.
Yeah, that's right.
Are there rules about property ownership on things like this? I mean, and who enforces those rules?
You can actually, George, there's a guy that was selling property on the moon.
No, I've heard of him. Yeah,
but that's all bullshit, though.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like buying a star. It's one of those kind of things. Right. But is there like some kind of international?
Yes.
There's like an international treaty thing that lays it out, isn't there? Yeah. I don't know what it's called.
Yeah, but there is an international treaty which basically says no one owns the moon.
Yeah. You know, when it comes to stuff like this, I do feel more like companies like Virgin and Galactic, you know, that's where this is going to happen. Like Kickstarter, I don't trust Kickstarter to get the album I'm funding to get that done, you know, let alone, you know, a 10-year mission to send a robot to the moon.
But we'll see what happens.
I'm a little pessimistic.
We'll see what
happens.
Is
that a subtle dig on Ock? my project.
I didn't even think of that. No, that is egregious. Yeah.
When's that coming, by the way, Jason, since you bring it up? 2 weeks?
I'll tell you guys. So we just finished the trailer, and the trailer for Ock the Skeptical Caveman miniseries is going to be out. I have it ready to go. I'm going to upload it as soon as I get some free time. And then we are just now waiting for the music to be done.
All right. Does anybody know what tree I'm standing in front of in this picture?
Is it the giving tree?
I think I heard someone say ginkgo biloba. That's right. That's a ginkgo biloba tree, which is I couldn't resist. So ginkgo biloba is a supplement, an herb that's marketed for memory and prevention of dementia or declining cognition with age. It doesn't work. There's no reason to think that it does work. There's really no plausibility to it. There's always a hand-waving explanation, though, when you ask the marketers or the promoters, well, how is it supposed to work? They always have to say something, right? So this one is so thin. This one always amazed me. What they say is, well, ginkgo has a blood-thinning effect, which will increase blood flow to the brain and therefore improve your memory and cognition and prevent dementia. So that sounds superficially plausible if you're not a scientist or a physician and have no idea what you're talking about. So aspirin, of course, is a better blood thinner, and we have really, we know exactly what dose to give you. We've kind of dialed it in. So if that claim, if that mechanism were correct, aspirin would be more effective than ginkgo at having the same benefits. But in any case, it's been studied in large clinical trials. There's no effect. There's no benefit from taking ginkgo. Doesn't stop it from being a multi-million dollar industry, even still.
Steve, haven't you done this story already?
Yeah, I might have done it and forgot about it.
Take more aspirin.
Evan.
Yeah.
Apparently, the Amazing Meeting has its own airline now.
I mean, TAM Airlines. Okay, so why is this up here? Well, a renowned Brazilian psychic spooked an airline into changing a plane's flight number after he claimed to have a vision that the aircraft was going to crash. His name is Ulisseno Nobega da Luz. But, you know, he's famous because he predicted the death of Princess Diana, so therefore somehow that makes him an authority. And he informed the airline that he had a premonition that this plane was going to have an engine problem. So what does the airline do? They go ahead and listen to him, believe him, and they went ahead and changed the flight number.
Yep. Wait. If they believed him, wouldn't they change the engine?
Isn't that kind of like moving the tombstones but not moving the caskets?
Yeah, that's right.
Right, or like going to a psychic and she says, you know, Rebecca Watson's going to die in a week. And it's like, well, good news, I just changed my name to Joe.
Like shuffling deck chairs on the Titanic, I suppose. The flight was designated JJ37220, and now it was designated JJ4732. So I suppose there's a compromise of some sort that was reached. But, you know, an airline listening to a psychic and, like, giving him any credence whatsoever in any way.
Well, did it work?
Oh, yeah. Apparently it did, but,
good.
You know. Who knows?
Evan.
Will we ever really know?
Ev.
Jay.
Did the psychic recommend they change the name?
No, that was up to the airline themselves. They say, the airline stated that because it believes passenger security is most important, it felt the urge to make the change in light of the indispensable information. And that's a quote. Indispensable information. So they are definitely paying attention to what this psychic says.
But the airline is in a no-win scenario because passengers may cancel their tickets because they heard that this famous psychic predicted that their flight was going to crash. So even if the airline doesn't believe the psychic at all, you know, they kind of have to do something about it. Either they need to completely ignore it and hope that it's not out there. But if the guy's famous...
Right.
You know?
Yeah, but have you seen airline change fees recently? Like, they probably made bank off of that.
That's true.
maybe they were behind the whole thing.
That's a strategy.
Yeah.
This particular psychic also foresaw that a cure for AIDS would be found in 2008. Kind of got that one wrong. Now, there's a lot of superstition having to do with airlines. It's not just this one. For example, there used to be an airline called Continental Airlines, ran out of the United States before it was bought by United, which happened to be the airline we took over here, if I'm not mistaken. And Continental refused to ever have a flight number 13, and at their hubs in America, they would never have a gate number 13. Just refused. Outright refused.
Wow.
Some other numbers that are shunned are Bob 666.
My favorite number.
Bob 666?
Yeah. I'm getting Bob's attention to make sure he heard me. That's his favorite number, for those who were paying attention the other night. And also 9/11. They shun that as well. Here you go. Here's a little interesting fact. Of 102 airlines tracked by SeatGuru.com, 25 of those airlines have no row 13 on their planes. So that's roughly 25% of airlines.
Yeah, because if you sit in the 13th row, you're the one who's going to die in an airline crash. Everyone else is going to be fine. Right?
But row 14 is row 13.
Only if you're counting.
Just so there's still a 13th row. It's just called Tim. Or fruit basket. You call it whatever you call it. It's still the third.
I like the idea of getting rid of numbers altogether. I'm sitting in fruit basket A. Tim, no, fruit basket, here we go.
The thought came to mind that we might want to move to maybe Roman numerals, you know, kind of get away of the whole image of the number 13, but, you know, that doesn't exactly work either, because in some places, like Italy, the number 17 is regarded as kind of an unlucky number, because in Roman numerals, it's XV11, which can create the word VIXI, VIXI, translated from Latin to mean, my life is over.
I have wasted my life. Simpsons reference, thank you.
Wow.
So there you have it, superstition all around us.
It's true. Unfortunately, I discovered this myself earlier this year. My mother was going under quite a long process of chemotherapy, and I'd travel and help her out with that. And we'd be waiting in the office there for her to have a weekly blood test, and you file in, you take a number from the little tray there, and of course it was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 14, 15. And I thought, of all the places, my mother is being treated with the very best of what we have to offer in our scientific era, but you can't have a number 13 when you're giving blood.
Wasn't it true that in Asian countries, buildings don't have a fourth floor the same way we don't have a 13th floor?
Yep, that's right.
And the same people that would believe in an unlucky 13th floor would look at a fourth floor missing and be like, that's ridiculous. Why would you not have a fourth floor? And the fourth floor people are like, gosh, why would you not have a 13th floor? That's crazy.
Because the word for the number four sounds like the word for death. That's why there's that superstition.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
This is the former EU chief science advisor, Professor Anne Glover. And this is a very interesting topic to talk about, the relationship between politics and science, and specifically, how do politicians get science advice to inform their policies and their legislation? So what happened in this case is that Professor Glover, apparently, by all accounts, as the EU's chief science advisor, was doing an excellent job. She was great at bringing in a variety of experts and the full scientific community to exploit their expertise and provide science advice to the president of the EU. However, she was openly pro-GMO. And this was not a popular opinion in Europe. And even among skeptics, at least in the U.S., there is still, I think, there's a pretty significant subset of skeptics who have a problem with genetically modified organisms. Mainly, when I get down to it, this is my experience, I don't have any survey or anything, when you get down to it, it always comes down to, I just don't like Monsanto and the companies that are controlling our food infrastructure and raping the poor farmers. You know, that's basically what it comes down to.
I have a different opinion than that.
Go ahead.
I personally want there to be regulation to make sure that there's oversight.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Right? Yeah, no question. So, I mean, I get that. I mean, obviously, we don't want corporations to be unregulated and to be, feel free to pursue profits and be mad scientists and all that stuff. Sure. But that's a separate discussion, whether or not they are adequately regulated. And again, that's a country-by-country kind of discussion. But among the general population, if you ask them what their problem is, they say because of health scares. They don't think it's safe or healthy, because that's what they're being told. But of course, the scientific evidence shows there's absolutely no health concern about genetically modified organisms, at least all the ones that are currently on the market, or even in the pipeline. I mean, obviously, it's organism by organism. You can't make a lot of general statements about the technology itself. In any case, that's a scientific question. That's exactly what we mean by scientists advising political discussion. You can have a political discussion about how to regulate the industry, but you should at least understand the science behind the safety, the science behind the technology, the environmental impacts, et cetera, because otherwise it's all going to be political spin and propaganda. And that's essentially what's been happening. So in this case, Professor Glover was giving her advice. Well, the scientific community agrees that genetically modified technology is a safe technology and doesn't present any particular problem for the environment. It all depends on how it's being employed or how it's being used. And that was a very unpopular position for her. France, in particular, really hated her. And Greenpeace and other environmental organizations wrote an open letter to the EU president recommending that her position be eliminated. What's interesting is that defenders of this decision and Greenpeace and others saying that the reason for this was they thought that the chief advisor position had too much power. It was too much left on one person. But I honestly doubt that Greenpeace would have been expressing their opinion on the infrastructure of science advice in the EU if it weren't for this GM issue. Clearly, they had a problem with her stance on GM, and they did mention that. They were successful in pressuring the EU president, who also is anti-GMO, so he didn't like the advice he was being given also, to not only overrule her or ignore her advice, but to, in fact, eliminate the position itself. They didn't just fire her from the position. There is now no EU science advisor for the European Union.
That's incredible.
Beyond belief.
It's exactly that. It's not just fire her, but eliminate the position. I wonder if the reason why that was done is because they would have needed a reason to fire her.
That's so often the case.
Eliminating the position, they can say, well, sorry.
Right.
That decision says is we don't need any educated information about science.
And we don't need no education.
Yeah.
Well, Steve, it's also saying we need our scientific experts, not a general expert for everyone, but we want to pick who informs us on the science. I think that's important.
I agree. I think politicians want to pick the science. They don't want science to constrain their politics, right? I think that's ultimately what it's about.
That's 180 degrees wrong.
I know. Absolutely.
All right, wait, before you move on, though, I mean, what can we do about this? Collectively, as a skeptical community, like we really do need to address this.
One thing you could do is express your political opinion. Write your representative, whoever that is, and let them know that you want strong science advice, objective, untainted science advice informing political decision making.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this advice mostly goes to people in the EU.
But every country is dealing with this.
Yeah.
It's not just the EU. I mean,
about this specific instance.
Yeah, this specific instance. Yeah, absolutely.
We're going to need people in the EU to.
But, yeah. So for example, in the United States recently, a very similar issue came up. The House, which is controlled currently by Republicans, passed H.R. 1422, the EPA, that's the Environmental Protection Agency, Science Advisory Board Reform Act of 2014. So this is the Science Advisory Board. This is a board of expert scientists with relevant expertise who advise policy on the Environmental Protection Agency, which is an agency that can't function. It's all about science. I mean, that's what it's doing. There were two provisions in the bill that passed the House. And just to put it into perspective, it's not a law yet. The bill would have to pass the Senate and then would have to knock it vetoed by Barack Obama, which probably is not going to happen. There were two things that stuck out. One was this, I'll quote from the bill itself, that advisory board members will, quote unquote, not be excluded from the board due to affiliation with or representation of entities that may have a potential interest in whatever the board is reviewing. So in other words, you can work for a company being regulated by the EPA and be an expert on the advisory council of the EPA. Yeah, that's choosing your scientists, right? They want the ability to choose the scientists even if they are having a significant, they will not be excluded because of any affiliation or representation of the company.
Why would they
no standards.
Do that? I mean, that's basically formalizing lobbying in the governing body.
Yeah.
That's why they did that.
Yeah. Now, of course, they always have a justification for it. What they say is that, well, environmental groups like Greenpeace, you could work for them and be on the advisory committee, so it's not fair. We're excluding industry scientists, but not lobbying environmental scientists. And there's a, you know, there's a kernel of truth there in that you want to have a broad representation. And I wouldn't say that we shouldn't have any industry representation on the council, but this is specifically opening the door wide without there being any limitation. What I would say, what I would prefer is saying that trivial connections to industry does not exclude you. A significant affiliation or representation. Like, if you essentially work for the company, you shouldn't be on an advisory panel that's advising about issues that deal with your company. That's a clear conflict of interest. But for completeness, there is also a clause in the same bill that says if a member of the advisory board has a conflict of interest, they will be excluded from testimony on that particular item. So they do then mitigate it a little bit with that. But still, This is very, very problematic.
Perfectly reasonable. That's why it will never happen.
Like everything, it always comes down to how is this going to be employed? And if you're cynical, which I think is actually reasonable when it comes to politics, then it seems like they're just trying to give themselves the leeway to cherry pick their experts.
Right.
You know, here's the other component of this, which is very problematic. Board members may not participate in activities that directly or indirectly involve review or evaluation of their own work. Let that sink in for a second. That essentially means an expert cannot give testimony on the area of their expertise.
Oh, great.
I mean, that directly or indirectly. I mean, think about that, or indirectly. If it said that they can't give testimony about studies that they themselves have published, I could see, okay, maybe they're not, you want to talk about other scientists evaluating their work, not have them evaluate their own work, okay. But to say that you can't talk about anything that indirectly touches your area of research, that's ridiculous. That's just, I don't even know what the hell they're
thinking. How is that in practice? I mean, does that mean that they have an expert or someone that did research and they want to know about the research and then they have to have some other person come in and communicate about the research?
Well, I mean, so you have a dozen people on the advisory committee. If the topic comes up dealing with climate change and you're a climate change scientist, you can't give testimony about it. You can't participate in the discussion because you've published studies that indirectly or directly impact the topic of discussion. That clearly smacks of, we want to put in their language that will give us an excuse to exclude anyone we want.
Right.
Right. Yep. So there's the, we can include anyone we want and we can exclude anyone we want. That's the two punch here.
Yeah.
I don't know of any other way to really interpret that.
Richard, wasn't there something with an Australian science advisor recently getting the boot? Did that happen?
So they eliminated the position?
Yeah, we don't have a minister for science, which we've had for years and
clearly years. What happened was, they're like, oh, that's a good idea. Yeah. The EU's got it right. Let's just get rid of all the scientists.
Yeah, it's a very sad situation. I think a lot of people have issues with our current government. Of course, people always have issues with any current government. But at the moment, I think that's of a particular concern, yeah.
Is there a state religious representative of some? Is there like a state?
A minister of ministry?
Minister of ministry, yes. That's called the prime minister. Very good.
Good one. Good one.
Very good. 5 points.
Oh. So, guys, putting it to you directly, I mean, if you recently had this position eliminated, like, the local skeptical community needs to do something about this. You guys should really figure out a way to get your voice heard.
I think this is a good issue for the overall skeptical movement internationally. This is a topic we could sink our teeth into. Proper science advice and positions to government. That could have a huge impact. And it's the kind of thing, it's also a win-win for us in a way, because some issues are a hard sell. You know, it's like really hard to convince somebody who already isn't scientifically literate or a critical thinker. There's no way you could argue against this, right? This is a position that we could take very strongly. We want good science to advise our politicians. Who would argue against that? They're now in the position of having to make some kind of nuanced argument about whatever. But this would be a really good issue for us to push just internationally. And I think all these recent events is a good impetus for that. This is one we should keep pushing. Right. So, All right, Bob, tell us about nano something.
Nano sculptures. You're looking at the smallest sculpture, piece of art, probably ever. Certainly the smallest piece of art depicting the human form. That's obviously an eye of a needle. You can see that little bump there is actually a sculpture, the tiniest one. It was created using a 3D printing process, and it's so small that the best way to view it is using an electron microscope.
Wow.
The artist's name is Jonty Hurwitz. He's clearly very minimalist. That sculpture right there is about 20 by 80 by 100 microns. It can fit on a human hair. To get a sense of how small this is, if you just kind of like wait 6 hours, one of your nails will have gained more mass than one of his sculptures. The process for creating this is interesting. It started with not a lone artist, but 15 specialists, as you could imagine. It took a lot of people to put this together. It started in a warehouse with human models, life-size human real models, and they created a dome with about 200 very high-precision cameras to create all sorts of 3D data on the models. And that was the easy part. After that, it took 10 months in front of a computer, manipulating virtual models, rendering. And this is where the real sculpting comes in, Jay, at this phase. And the artist calls it digital clay. And then after that process was done, then the actual creation of the artwork actually started. It's, like I said, it was 3D printing. Specifically, it was multi-photon lithography that was used to create this.
What was it made out of? Like, what's the printed material?
The material is a polymer. Have you guys ever been to a dentist, and the dentist uses a UV light to harden a bonding material? It's similar to that, except they use a very very high-powered near-infrared laser that focuses on a polymer material, and where that is focused creates these hardened grains called their voxels, which is a three-dimensional analog to a pixel. So these three-dimensional grains. And then the computer would then would move just a tiny little bit and then harden another piece. And you can imagine this process would take countless hours, days, and weeks to slowly build up even these tiny little things. So unfortunately, you'll never be able to see this with your own eyes for two reasons. First off, it's too small, right?
You could actually have that sculpture in your eye. You wouldn't even know.
True. And the second reason why you'll never see this is that some Fruit Loop lost them. This guy created 15 sculptures like this, and somebody just lost them, and they'll never find them again because you can't see. Like,
here are all the sculptures, and the guy sneezes. Oh!
Right.
With this technology, though, Bob, I mean, think about it. They're making things that small. You know, where do you see the applications going? Like, you know, this isn't just art. It has a impact on technology, no?
Computer circuits, transistors, things like that. Once we have that level of control over in such a small domain, sure, I think it's wide open for so many different things. I don't even think we're realizing now where it's really going to go. But
it's not really ready for prime time yet. It's not ready for mass production. It takes hours to make one little thing.
Right, and it needs to be more automated because, I mean, the effort just to create these little guys was so long. Imagine building something bigger would just take too much time. But
imagine
the
future,
infancy.
Aliens come and human race is gone and they're scanning the earth for stuff and they like find this and they're like, wow, these people were so small.
This stuff is going to be used for things we can't even imagine.
No.
Yeah.
And even in 10 years, there'll be things that we can't even imagine. Now, if we could, we'd invest in the company and become millionaires.
I agree. Yeah, you got to start somewhere. All right, George.
Oh, boy.
You're going to tell us about Kirk Cameron's attempt to save Christmas.
Yes, our good friend Kirk Cameron, some of you might know Kirk Cameron because of his good friend Ray Comfort, he of the Atheist's Nightmare, the banana. Kirk puts out films every couple of years, sort of self-funded, and his latest attempt at a movie, in terms of that there is, you know, a moving image apart from that, is called Saving Christmas. There it is, the subtlety of Kirk Cameron, Saving Christmas. And in essence, the plot of this film, or the point of this film, is he's trying to show that pagans stole Christmas traditions from Christians because the Bible. That's literally the film. He plays himself, and he goes to a family Christmas gathering, and there is a character, I'm not making this up, there is a character whose name is Christian White.
Whitey Corngood.
You could choose any character name you want, and they chose Christian White. So yeah, so he does say, because there is a veiled reference to a Christmas tree in the Bible, that in essence, pagans stole all of Christmas traditions, and that this is a huge conspiracy and a myth that Christmas traditions actually come from pre-Christian times. That's the movie. An interesting thing happened in that on the Rotten Tomatoes website, which is a movie review website, it had a fresh rating. It's 1 to 100. It had a fresh rating of like 6.
That high, huh?
So, of course, Kirk went to his Twitter followers, because he has, I think, a million Twitter followers or something, and he said, we need to fix this. We need to make this a better rating. So
it
went
down
up
to 5.
And it got to a 96% fresh rating. And then a bunch of people that actually know how film works saw that and responded, and it went back down to about a 30 fresh rating. So it was this kind of ping-pong back-and-forth ideological rating war that was going back and forth. Now, I don't know if everyone's aware of where our Christmas traditions do come from. They do not come from Christian traditions. They come from definitely pre-Christian traditions. It's in essence, it's Saturnalia is what we're celebrating. And it's this idea that it is cold, the sun has gone away, and we need to figure out how to bring it back. So you celebrate things like evergreens. Evergreens have the magical, they stay green year round. So you have to find out what that magical thing is that's in the green. I liked this, during Saturnalia, children used to be given, wax dolls. Now the dolls were used to represent human sacrifices that Rome had given to Saturn. So think about that when you're opening up your Transformer toy next time. Represents a nice little human sacrifice. Stockings. Children in Scandinavian countries would leave stockings. Actually, they would leave their shoes out with food in the shoes. And this was for Odin's horse. And so that turned into, of course, stockings being stuffed with things. Wreaths were, you know, the laurel wreaths. Laurel wreaths go back way, way to prehistory. They're celebrating all kinds of stuff. Trees, Christmas trees, again, pre-Christian winter festivals. This represents immortality and fortitude. It's also in Egyptian culture and Chinese culture and Hebraic cultures. You worship trees and you celebrate the trees that stay green through the seasons. Mistletoe. Mistletoe, the Greeks believe that Aeneas, the famous ancestor of Romans, carried a sprig of mistletoe as the legendary golden bough. Now, we're not really sure why people kiss underneath it. That started around the 16th century. We're not sure why. But what's awesome is that if you eat mistletoe, you get diarrhea and stomach pain. So it might be kind of a subtle warning. I'm not sure exactly what it is.
What's the reference to the Christmas tree in the Bible? Do you know?
I'm not sure specifically what it is, but it's a very veiled, you know, some kind of tree existed.
Right.
And then maybe there was green, right, saith the Lord.
Nostradamus sort of quatrain.
Yeah, it's very veiled.
Yeah, and somewhere a pagan was like, this is a great idea.
Exactly, yeah. It's really fun. So go to Rotten Tomatoes and review this film. They are fun to watch with lots of friends and alcohol.
Drugs.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is just blatant historical revisionism. You know, I mean, it's not like we don't know what happened. What's interesting is not only is Christmas a pre-Christian tradition, all of Christianity is a pre-Christian tradition and philosophy. Everything has pre-Christian roots in Greek philosophy, in all of the mythology that was happening in the region at the time. I mean, there's so much historical information. Although, unfortunately, a lot of the times that we've talked about on the show, people oversimplify that and get it wrong, like saying that all the details of the Christian story were in the Mithras cult. That's not true. But all of the elements of the Savior, of the resurrection, of all of those things, it had many, many iterations in every culture in that region. There is nothing unique about
Except for that part where those kids make fun of the bald guy and then God kills them with bears.
Yeah, that's pre-Christian Judaism.
Oh,
yeah.
Damn.
Rebecca, you're going to tell us why teenagers are what they are. We'll leave it at that.
Settle in, everybody. I mean, I'm one of the few people up here without children. Several of you have teenagers, so maybe you can weigh in on this research. Researchers have found that teenagers' brains shut down when they hear criticism from their mothers. Does this jibe with what you,
shocking.
You know?
Absolutely. It's like the Death Star.
But why from the mothers? Why?
Well, yeah, the study only tested, the voices of their mothers. So what they did was they took 40 teenagers, some of whom, a wide range of ages and, about half and half, a few more girls than boys, and, some of whom had depression and others had a clean psychological bill of health. And they put them in a brain imaging machine and they had them listen to their mother, either criticizing them for 30 seconds, just talking about mundane things like, you know, what they're cooking for dinner or what work was like, something like that. And, I just love this idea that some researchers somewhere were like, let's get some teenagers and make them listen to their mothers nagging them and then look at what happens in their brains. So what they found was that obviously there was an increase in quote-unquote negative emotions, which, yeah, is obvious. But also they found that the teenagers, during their time listening to their mothers and for a period of time afterwards, had reduced brain activity in areas related to emotional control and empathy. And so what the researchers are guessing about that is that the teenagers, oh, and by the way, there was no difference between girls and boys and between different age ranges and between kids with depression and those with no psychological problems. And so they believe that when kids are being criticized, they're not empathizing with their parents. They're not considering their parents' emotional state at the time. Or there are possible reasons for criticizing their kids. And they suspect that this has something to do with the teenagers preventing an emotional spiraling from happening. So there are a number of issues with the study, but I wanted to talk about it because, again, I find it hilarious that they force teenagers to listen to their mother.
So it's like the dampening rods in a nuclear reaction.
Yes, yes, exactly.
They don't want it to melt down.
Right, to prevent meltdown, yeah, that their brain just sort of shuts down.
Yeah.
The researchers did only look at the mother's voices. They haven't tested father's voices.
I can almost guarantee it's the same from dad's.
But couldn't it also be just maybe if it was worse. White noise or if it was just someone going, you know, I don't know, like a podcast or something,
non-parents.
Just, you know, talking endlessly?
That's
non-critical
the other thing.
Feedback. I mean, there's That's lots of variables there.
One of the criticisms of the study is that their controls weren't spectacular. They didn't play the teenagers other non-parental things. And they did compare criticism to the mother just talking about her day or whatever, and did find that the criticism led to the shutdown while the other didn't. But, they didn't play any other sounds. And also, they didn't give the teenagers instructions on what they should be doing while listening, which is apparently, something that can be critical when you're doing brain imaging studies, because you want the brain to be doing a specific thing that you're going to be looking at. So it's a bit, post hoc, maybe. You know, they're just, looking at what happened when they, just stuck the teens in the machine.
Yeah. Well, it's a classic mistake to only test your own hypothesis.
Right.
Rather than also testing other possible hypotheses. So that kind of research at best is exploratory.
Mm-hmm.
And it sets up a hypothesis for later, you know, confirmatory testing where you have to actually then compare it to all these alternate hypotheses.
I would imagine that also, like, if you get down to the individual level, like, let's say somebody's parents or the mother in this case yells a lot.
Yeah.
I would imagine those kids would probably tune it out more than parents that don't
actually
yell as often.
You're incorrect. According to the researchers, the kids who reported that they were that their parents were more understanding of them and less likely to criticize them had more of that sort of shutdown thing happening.
Why would that be?
No idea.
Yeah, that's
interesting.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, but
so, and the researchers admit that there are faults in the study, and so they are clearly expecting other researchers or maybe even themselves to follow this up by torturing more teenagers.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with that.
I just want to see the ads like for you know, wanting test subjects. Like, do you yell at your kids? Come on in. Yeah. Well, you know, are you bored with your parents and they yell at you a lot? We got a study for you. It's like, make $5 an hour.
Dysfunctional families wanted.
Right. Yeah.
But it's fun for us to talk about this, but I always get a little annoyed. It's like, this really isn't at the level where it should be reported to the press, because you know the headlines are teenagers' brains shut down when their parents talk to them, and that's all they're going to really know. That's the bottom line. They're going to walk away from it. It could be a one-off study that doesn't get replicated, it turns out that any sound will shut their brain down in the same way. Whatever. Once you actually do all the controls for the variables. But now that meme is out there. I'm sure I'll be hearing it at some point. You know, I read a study where, you know, teenagers' brains shut down.
Not from your teenagers, though. You won't hear it from them.
They weren't listening.
Exactly.
The sad thing is that scientists might be releasing that information because they need funding. You know, I always think of that.
Or the university likes to get press for their institution, so they look for interesting results from their researchers and then hype it.
How do we avoid that? That is such an awesome headline. How could we prevent them from grabbing that headline and running with it?
I mean, you can't. I don't know. I mean, obviously, we're always trying to educate journalists, improve the quality of journalism. We do need that second wave of science bloggers to say, wait a minute, let's put this into perspective, and that helps. And sometimes the journalists come back at that. You know, I've had that experience, too, where they get the first round of sensational hype, and then you debunk it, essentially, and some other reporter, or maybe even the original might say, you know what, okay, maybe we blew the first round. Help us get it right on the second round. Well, then they usually put themselves in the position of criticizing other people's bad reporting, which I've seen that happen a lot. Even when they were the first ones to do it, they still then they take the high ground. And they get another round out of it as well. But at least the second round is better.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I do think science blogging has a very positive impact on that. You know.
One other quick thing I wanted to mention about the study that might be something you could comment on, Steve, is the idea that, you know, whenever we talk about brain imaging scans, there's always this idea that there's one part of the brain that relates to X and another part of the brain that relates to Y. So in this case, they associated processing negative emotions with the limbic system, regulating emotion with the prefrontal cortex, and understanding other people's perspective was linked to the junction of the temporal and parietal lobes.
Yeah. Those general localizations are correct.
Yeah.
But you're right that that's always an oversimplification. So there's multiple layers of complexity here. We could spend the whole hour talking about this, just very quickly. You know, the brain, it's not like one part of the brain does one thing. Different parts of the brain participate in multiple networks doing different things at different times. And so when we're seeing what's lighting up on an fMRI scan, which itself is an aggregate of multiple trials of multiple subjects, and we're sort of squeezing out a little bit of signal from the noise, it's a mess. And that's also why fMRI studies, you know, half of them are crap. And the rest need to be replicated really carefully before we could draw any conclusions from it. So it's very difficult to interpret these kinds of studies. You're right. That's another entire layer that we haven't even talked about.
And there's that classic dead fish in the fMRI machine study.
You can get signal. You can, you know, cheat signal out of a dead fish's brain. Yeah, that's what that showed.
Is the fish's parent talking to it while it's happening?
I'm going to talk just a little bit, quick overview of wind power, because this topic comes up a lot, and I never did a really deep dive on it. So I just wanted to give you some statistics about wind power. So since obviously this is something that's being used in Australia as well as the U.S., and there's a lot of misgivings about it, like, you know, how much does it really generate? Are those things safe? There's something called wind turbine syndrome. Is it real? So typically, a typical large wind turbine, like the ones you're seeing in this picture rimming Lake George, put out 1.5 megawatts. That's their maximum energy output.
Do you know what that turns into? Like, how many houses can that power?
Exactly. So the wind, that occurs when the wind is blowing between 30 and 55 miles per hour. That's the sweet spot.
Yeah.
Below 30 miles an hour, the production drops down to negligible. There are 2 to 3 megawatt models available, but the most common 1.5 megawatt at 25% efficiency, which is like an average efficiency, meaning that's 25% of the time the wind is blowing in the sweet spot, that can power about 320 homes.
Oh yeah, that's
good. One of those windmills can power 320 homes. So that's more than I thought, actually. That's pretty good. That's the good news. The good news is it's a way of generating clean energy, and they actually can do pretty well if they're put in a place that has reasonable wind efficiency.
And the bad news is that every bird that Steve took a picture of is dead because of those turbines.
Well, there are different estimates to how many birds windmills kill. So that's one of the concerns is that these things, you know, these large spinning blades are a hazard to flying creatures. I've read as many estimates as I could find. Essentially, the systematic reviews of estimates show that between 140,000 and 328,000 bird deaths are caused each year by windmills.
By all windmills.
Right? So that sounds like a lot.
Yeah.
Let's take the high number, say 300,000. But compare that to the number of birds killed by cats, which is 1.3 to 4 billion birds a year by cats.
So we should get rid of the cats.
That was an idea floated in New Zealand fairly recently. A scientist suggested that they ban cats from the island, which did not go over well.
Guess how many birds die from flying into windows?
A million.
100 million. So
we gotta ban windows.
You gotta put the little bird stickers on them. You can't engineer building windows so that they're less of a hazard to birds. You can't do that.
You can't tint them.
You can.
And that was a huge problem recently in Minnesota. They, built a new football stadium, I believe, and against the advice of bird researchers, they built it in a way that's gonna murder a bunch of birds, basically.
Very bad.
Yeah. Also did not go over well.
This one back, there we go. I'm embarrassed. I totally forgot to do this at the beginning. I just got a sign from
the bathroom. Bathroom's that way, George.
Yeah, I know. The Australian Skeptics wanted to recognize the excellence of the Skeptics Guide crew, and they wanted to award them. I totally forgot to do this. I'm sorry. This is supposed to be up front. It's the first ever, it's the James Randi Award for Excellence, and I thought it was going to be out here, but it's backstage. It's beautiful. You have to see this thing. So this is the first ever James Randi Award for. Let me grab it. Hold on one sec. It's very lifelike.
Am I turning fuchsia?
I'm really looking forward to this.
It's so lifelike. It's incredible.
Who am I and what am I doing here?
Well, Randi, welcome to Australia.
Well, I am very, very pleased to be here, ladies and gentlemen. As you might imagine, I arrived just yesterday, just flew in yesterday, and my arm's tired. Good to be back in this part of the world again. It's been quite a while. And if I'm the Randi Award, I guess somebody gets to take me home.
I was going to ask that.
Do I have choice? Good to be here. Good to see you again, Steve. Well, all of you guys, of course. Yes. And George hasn't changed one bit. I wanted to talk to you about that, George.
I have one question, Randi. So can you tell us why you're here in Australia or doing a tour?
Yes, for the movie An Honest Liar. That's ça c'est moi. I am the honest liar. Would I lie to you? Oh, yeah. You bet, but I do it as an entertainer, you see. But the James Randi Educational Foundation, and most of us have been fighting for so many years, is the fact that there are scallywags out there who don't tell you that they're using their professional skills to fool you by means of simple magic tricks. The magicians have always been much aware of this, of course. I should say the conjurers. It's a much better term than magicians. Mm-hmm. We're not magicians. We don't do real magic. We do conjuring, which is imitation stuff, you see. And we admit it quite frankly. And we think that those who are out there who are deceiving people, costing them great large sums of money, of course, along with destroying their emotional security in many cases and destroying them in so many other ways, really intellectually, certainly. We feel that these are the ones that we are fighting, and we fight unreason and lack of critical thinking. Critical thinking, those are the two words, ladies and gentlemen. Never let them leave your vocabulary. Critical thinking is extremely important. It's critical to our survival, as a matter of fact, or we could be in, what's the expression? Oh, yeah, deep shit. Speaking as Penn and Teller might. As a matter of fact, I brought a message for you, as Teller said to me the other day.
That was good. Very good.
Yes, critical thinking is extremely important to us, folks. And if we don't do more of it, we can suffer greatly. And you can see the way the world is confused about reality in the news every day now across the entire globe. We're facing all kinds of critical situations, and something must be done about it.
The film is excellent. I think the response to the film has been, everyone I've spoken to that's seen An Honest Liar, it's a really wonderful documentary, and it really shows a different side of Randy. How have you found the response to be?
This side.
The back, yeah. How have you found the response at viewings?
George, it's been just breathtaking. We started out knowing that there would be a certain reaction to the film, of course. But frankly, I'm amazed. How could that be? it's been very, very gratifying. I meet people after every showing of the film. They come to me and they hold me by the hand. And so many times, folks, I get people saying, "Mr. Randy, you made a big change in my life." You can't buy that. You cannot buy that kind of expression from somebody when they look at you straight in the eye with the tears in the eyes saying, "You made a big change in my life." I feel that responsibility right to the soles of my feet, I can tell you that. And it is very gratifying to know that perhaps I and the James Randi Educational Foundation and the whole skeptical movement has made a difference in the lives of people around the world. Never forget that. We are important, and what we think and what we preach, I hate to use that word.
Thank you. Randy, without exaggeration, it was you, Carl Sagan, and Star Trek. That's why this podcast exists. I mean, seriously, you were one of the major motivators for us and inspirations for us.
Well, when you mentioned Carl, wow, what a giant. An absolute giant, and it was my privilege to know him on a rather intimate level in several circumstances, and I got to visit him personally at his beautiful home. And I still know Anne Druyan, of course, his last wife. And as a matter of fact, I'll share a little anecdote with you. Anne called me one day after Carl had died, and she said that she had received letters from people asking me about a rumor that was going around that he made a deathbed conversion to Christianity. I mean, can you imagine any more bizarre claim than that? And Anne told me, she said, "I held Carl's hand as he died. And I looked at him, and he smiled, and I said, 'Goodbye, Carl.' And he said, 'Goodbye, Anne.' And he closed his eyes, and he died." You can't get a stronger exit than that. I mean, That's really touching, very, very touching. And she said, "We knew, as we said those words, we were never going to see one another again, and it was okay. It was very sad, but it was okay." Now, would that all of us, and I'm not asking you to be an atheist now, don't get the wrong idea, but if only all of us had that way of facing our ends. I have no fear, myself personally. This is just my personal statement. I have no fear of dying whatsoever. I'm not ready. I mean, I'm not ready. But you've got to, I think you've got to live that way. Just be satisfied that you did the best while you were here. Now, I've got a few years left, I'm sure of that. But I intend to live them to the fullest. And that's what brought me to Australia, and here I am, so there. Other questions, other comments?
Do you have time for some
more?
Yeah,
we have a question right here. Yep.
I have a question.
I may have an answer.
Do you still have a $1 million reward for people who can prove that FC works?
Oh, I left it at home. Yeah. Oh, yes.
Yep.
The $1 million offer never really went away. We discussed the possibility at one time, a few years ago. I must say that the offer of $1 million prize for evidence of any paranormal, occult, or supernatural event of any kind under proper observing conditions, I get used to saying that, we thought that it would really shake up the world and it would be something to flaunt as a banner. It didn't work out that way. I frequently talk to people over the telephone from my office in Plantation, Florida, and I look out the window and I say to reporters that I'm speaking with, and often on Skype, and I will look out the window and say, gee, I don't see any lineup of people with petitions in their hands and applications for the $1 billion prize. Why not? That's my question. If they can do it, they win $1 million. Also, we made the offer with the $1 billion that if anyone doubted that it was accessible and available, all they had to do was to write us, or they could use ESP or a Ouija board or anything they wanted, to reach us and ask for the evidence. Not one of these people has ever asked for the evidence, and I think that proves a rather interesting point. They really don't want to know. They don't want to know. They don't want to see the evidence of it in the bank. And we have all the papers all signed, sealed, and delivered, ready to be mailed out on a moment's notice to any part of the world if they doubt that the $1 billion prize exists. It is there. It's not my money. It's the money of the James Randi Educational Foundation, of course, and it was put in there by a very generous gentleman who prefers to go unnamed. And I must say that the fact that no one has actually asked for the evidence seems to prove a very good point to me. The $1 billion is still there. It's intact. And it makes money for us. It's invested, you see, and it makes money for the foundation. I wouldn't put it in a bag under the desk or something like that. It doesn't make any money that way. So there you go. I hope that answered your question.
Alas, the amazing Randi has to go. I recommend highly, if you get a chance to see Mr. Randi during his trip, see the film, An Honest Liar. It really is a moving, wonderful piece of work. This was a complete surprise for pretty much all of us. Thank you for doing this. And one more time, James Randi. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you very, very much, ladies and gentlemen. A great delight to be here.
So do you know how many bats they kill?
Yeah, tell me, Steve. We were talking about windows.
What's weird is Randi just shows up at Steve's house every once in a while like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, just shows up. Well,
magic. Now it's his contractual obligation as our award for the James Randi yeah. Skeptic of the Year.
Spend 1 month at everyone's house yeah. and just do a rotation. Yeah. Okay. All
right. I'd be like, oh, I've got Randi on my couch this month.
900,000.
Bats.
Okay. Every year. Not fruit bats, though, because they're all gone.
Right.
That's right.
They just chase them away.
Do I need to say it again?
Yeah. 900,000 bats.
Maybe that's how they got rid of them. They put up the wind turbines.
Probably. Is that what we're talking about?
The thing is,
wasn't it cats?
You know what? I've had dreams like this. It's like, yeah, I was on a panel with the SGU, and I'm in Australia, and like James Randi walks in, and then he leaves, and they're talking about fruit bats, and Jay's wearing a tie. It's such this weird dream.
I'm just gonna say one thing about wind turbine syndrome.
Yeah, yeah.
Nothing is derailing this train, you guys.
At what is it? At 500 meters. Your refrigerator is noisier than a wind turbine. That's all I'm going to say.
Okay.
Your refrigerator.
Great.
So Jay, Evan, and I are breaking in quickly to our live show prior to Science or Fiction to give you guys some interesting updates. Jay, I hear we have dates for Nexus 2015.
Yes, that is correct, Steve. I have this information to share with you.
Breaking news.
Please do.
April 9th to 12th, 2015 in New York City.
Yeah, so save the date. This is just our first save the date kind of announcement. And we have a, very interestingly, we're adding an entire day of science-based medicine. So the Thursday of the conference is going to be basically an attached science-based medicine conference. And then the usual Nexus conference will begin on Friday. So we're all really excited about that.
Oh, that's awesome. That's really great.
Would it be okay if I pose as a doctor and like just talk about stuff on that day?
Yeah, no.
No?
No, that's a different conference, Jay. That's good.
And also, hey, guys, hold on to your short pants.
All right.
I posted the Oct teaser. There's a teaser on YouTube, awesome. On the SGU YouTube channel. A little bit of a teaser to let you know that the four episodes are coming very soon. We're working very hard to finish things up. It's looking good. So watch the teaser, leave some comments, and just wait a little while longer, and the four episodes will be out.
Jay, is this like winter is coming in the Game of Thrones?
Well, no, I'm not going to write seven books, you know, to get to lead up to this. Like, we're damn close now. Like, essentially everything is finished and we're doing the final wrap up and quality control.
So our end of the year wrap up episode is coming up. You have about a week from when this episode goes up to send us your votes. And please do this. Send us your votes for your favorite episode, your favorite interview, science news item of the year, skeptical jackass of the year, skeptical hero of the year, and any other remembrances, the favorite quote, your favorite bit from the show. Just let us know what you liked about the SGU and science and skepticism this year so we could talk about it on our wrap-up episode.
Yeah, that's great, Steve. Also, we're going to be drawing the name of the winner of our contest for Who's That Noisy? All the winners from the weeks of 2014, their names are being put into a hat. We will draw it, and we will announce the winner on that show.
Yep, and the winner gets to join us for Science or Fiction in 2015. Hey, if there's time left to get a gift membership for the SGU, this is an excellent gift. You can give somebody the gift of skepticism and critical thinking. If you give a gift membership at the Damned Dirty Ape level or higher, the premium level or higher, then you get access to all of our premium content. These are extra bits that we publish most weeks. And we recorded a lot of material, including a lot of video when we were on our Australia-New Zealand trip. And a lot of that is going to be going up on premium content.
Now, the SGU membership is actually more valuable and interesting now. And over the upcoming months, like Steve said, we're going to publish a ton of stuff.
Well, let's get back to the rest of our live show in Sydney.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Is there a Vincent Gulliver in the audience? I'm seeing
right
a
here.
V.
There's a V.
Come on Vincent. Up. Come on up, Vincent.
Vincent Gulliver, come on up.
Give him, yeah, Vincent. Give him a round of applause.
George, can you? Come on here. Take that seat. Vincent, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Hi there.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
I emigrated to Australia 4 years ago from the UK. I'm from a place called Scunthorpe, originally. Oh. Sunny Scunny.
Famous for its getting around censorship. It's the filthiest word in
It's got
in
a profanity
English
in it, if you think about it. Scunthorpe.
You moved here for work?
No. The climate. It's a beautiful place. I love it.
Awesome.
You moved here for the fruit bats.
We have some in our tree at the back, actually.
Do, yeah. Yeah.
Can we go look?
Don't tell anyone. They're going to come over and bang.
No, this guy. Yeah, that guy.
Home with you. All right. Are you ready to play?
Wait. Tell everybody why he's here. Yeah, why is this guy here?
He just told us why he's here.
Are you ready
here
to play science or fiction?
Yes, Pudley.
This okay guy's the Australian James Randi.
You were the lucky winner who got the special golden ticket. You opened up your chocolate and you got the golden ticket.
Right? It's great.
Okay.
Well right done, Charlie.
All right. So we have a special science or fiction for this show. We're going to do things a little differently. Usually I poll the audience first. I'm not going to do that this time.
No.
I'm going to get the panelists' opinion first.
Okay.
And then we'll just see what the audience thinks.
Starting with Vincent.
No. Vincent will go last.
Okay. That's very odd.
Start with George.
I assume this is Australian
left
themed,
to right.
Then.
The theme is Australia.
Oh, who could have possibly guessed?
And I have no idea how easy or hard these are for you. So they were all new to me. So I'm just going to read them. Right. Number one, just keep your titters and what's not. If they're really easy, just keep the mystery for the panel for now, okay? In 1902, the Royal Australian Army went to war with the Red Kangaroo, declaring them an enemy of the state and shooting them on sight until the order was lifted in 1911. Number two, the first police force in Australia was called the Night Watch, the ranks of which were filled with well-behaved convicts. The Tasmanian crop circle mystery was solved when it was discovered that wallabies were eating poppy plants, getting high, and then hopping around in circles. And there's a fourth one,
really?
just because, you know, great, why not? I couldn't say. So security guards at Canberra's Parliament House were banned from using the word mate. The measure lasted 1 day. George, tell us what you think.
Oh my God. I love this country because three of these are real. Oh, I am so home. Okay, I'm going purely by, and this is a cheat, but I'm going to go by audience reaction, and I probably shouldn't, But I'm going to say that the Tasmanian crop circle mystery being solved by high wallabies, stoned wallabies, I'm going to say that that is the fiction. The other ones, I mean, declaring, you know, a communist kangaroo, I would totally understand being against. Especially in 1902, who knows what's going to be happening. The first police, I'm going to go with that too, because, you know, it's a nation of convicts. We all know that. It's on the flag. It says that, nation of convicts. Security guards. Yeah, great. I'm gonna say the stoned wallabies making crop circles is the fiction.
Okay. Bob?
Yeah, I'm gonna go with Gio on this one because I don't think you could make nice circles if you were high on poppies. I think it would be much more irregular than nice circles. So that's the only one that I have no idea otherwise.
Okay. Wow. Rebecca?
That's the only one I'm positive is correct. Having been high on poppies with wallabies in the past, that one makes perfect sense to me. And I have read stories of other animals getting high and causing similar puzzles for people. Yeah, I think that one's true. For me, it's between the kangaroo being shot on sight as an enemy of the state. Like, I get shooting it on sight as a pest because there's a ton of them. But enemy of the state's weird. The Night's Watch thing. Come on. Like, you know, that's... What are the chances that there's a Game of Thrones, like a perfect Game of Thrones reference in Australian history? But, you know, George is right about them being a nation of convicts, and if it's the first police force, then, yeah, I can kind of see that. But also, no, because the first police force would have been the people watching the convicts, right? So I'm going to say that that one's the fiction.
Okay, Jay?
So you're saying that
The Night's Watch exists only in the mind of George R. R. Martin.
Okay. Yeah, this is really hard, Steve. Like, I've been trying to puzzle this through. So the one about the red kangaroos, like, my big question there is they hunted them for 9 years. That's a long time. You know, I think you can kill a lot in, like, you know, a few months, but they were just doing it for 9 years. So that's one thing that I'm not sure about. This one with Night Rider or Night Watch, whatever that.
I would totally see a Knight Rider Game of Thrones mashup. Yeah. That would be amazing.
David Hasselhoff plays Ed Stark. That one seems so legit, but it also seems like you just reached into your bag of Australian lore and pulled out like this news item. So I'm not sure about that one. The crop circle one, I agree with Bob. Like, yeah, like they would be, it'd be so random that it wouldn't have any kind of. It would just look like a bunch of, like, knocked over corn. It wouldn't have a pattern to it, so I see that. And the one with mate, I think that's odd, too, because it's such a common word. I don't know why it would be ever thought, like, we shouldn't say this anymore. So I'm just going to go out on a limb and say I think the one with mate is the fake.
Okay, Evan?
I think the Night Watch one is the fiction for the same reasons Rebecca pointed out. Exact same.
All right, Vincent, tell us what you think.
I really don't know. I've been listening to you for the last 3.5 years.
You listen to instructions well.
Not so easy when you're on the panel.
Yeah, right?
Now you know.
You're screaming at the panel thing going, come on, it's number two.
Let's all look at Vincent. All right, go.
My first call was the Tasmanian crop circle. It just seemed just out there, but I'm tempted to go with the police one, number two. It seemed like the reference to the Game of Thrones Night Watch. I think I'm with that one. That sold me.
Okay.
Go with Rebecca.
That's right.
We got a good
you have even coverage.
Good coverage.
Okay.
Yeah, good coverage. I like that. That means I did a good
full
job.
Coverage.
All right. Now it's your turn.
So if you think number one is the fiction.
Say red kangaroo. Don't say
red. Oh, sorry, red kangaroo. If you think red kangaroo is the fiction, ready? Let's do it all together. Red kangaroo is the fiction. Okay.
Hey,
if you think the first police watch, the night watch, is the fiction, ready? Ready? I don't know what you're watching.
Ooh,
wow, good. I'm glad.
Okay.
To hear
okay.
That.
If you think the Tasmanian crop circles is the fiction, ready?
Okay, yeah, baby.
Front. And the banning of the word mate is the fiction. Ready? All right.
Not bad.
All right. That's, all right. Pretty
so
good spread.
Definitely
good
the
spread.
Wallabies.
Definitely the Wallabies was getting it, but it was not as easy as I thought.
So the one that sounded to be the most popular was the crop circle one.
Yeah, so let's start with number four. Let's start with number four.
I did just say
I'm not listening to my
Security
mother.
Guards at Canberra's Parliament House were banned from using the word mate. The measure lasted 1 day.
You're starting
day.
With my news item?
That one is...
Science.
Sorry, Jay. it was banned, so they banned it because they thought it was, you know, inappropriate for guards.
Too familiar?
Too familiar. But as soon as the measure was passed, it was condemned as un-Australian.
That is awesome.
And they got rid of it. One day. One day. So that one was true. All right. Let's go to number two.
Knight Rider.
The first police force in Australia was called the Night Watch, the ranks of which were filled with well-behaved convicts. Rebecca thinks that one is... The fiction? Did anyone else call
anymore.
That
the
fiction?
No,
you
no,
it was
no.
The fiction?
Fiction.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Oh, Evan did. No, and Evan and Rebecca. Yeah.
All right, and that one is science.
Yes!
Isn't that cool? I read that. I'm like, oh, I'm going to get
that
Rebecca on
good.
That one.
That's good.
The Night Watch filled with convicts. Yeah. That's perfect.
All right, it's definitely the kangaroo one, then.
There's a, King yeah. Crimson song called The Night Watch. That's why right. I knew it was pre Game of Thrones, yeah.
Damn.
That was awesome.
Steve,
okay.
Can we do something also unorthodox and everyone re-vote on which they think is a fake now?
No.
okay. Unorthodox.
It's not the wallet.
Let's go to number. Let's wrong. Go to number one.
Okay.
Go to number one. In 1902, the Royal Australian Army went to war with the Red Kangaroo, declaring them an enemy of the state and shooting them on sight until the order was lifted in 1911. Who on the panel thought that was the fiction? Nobody?
Nobody.
The audience pretty much bought this one, too. They think that the wallaby one is the fiction. And this one is the fiction.
Oh! So we all lost.
Yep. It was my second choice.
Now,
yeah.
What did happen was that the Australian Army, I don't know if it was a little bit after 1902, they did go to war with the emu. Because they were a menace in Western Australia, and they lost. The emu won.
What? How could that possibly happen?
They were outgunned.
They were outgunned. Yeah, the wow. emu.
There's great pictures from that peace treaty signing. It's really good. One side of the tables, all
was
these emus
like
trying
an
to
emu,
hold a pen,
like with a beret, smoking cigarettes. We must resist. You know, I don't know.
They pulled a George Washington on them, which. We know what that means. So George Washington won the Revolutionary War by essentially running and hiding from the British. Until they ran out of they couldn't maintain a war, you know, across the Atlantic. He eventually won a couple of battles. But really, like the first 2 years of the Revolutionary War, he lost every single battle, but it just became a war of attrition.
Yeah.
Anyway, the emus would run and hide so quickly, they couldn't hunt them down. They just couldn't get to them. As soon as one shot went off, they would scatter. And they just had to give up. So they lost.
They declared them an enemy of the
no,
state?
No, I made all that
okay.
up.
Yeah,
that,
that
all stuff,
the,
I made all that yeah. up. Yeah. Okay, which means that the Tasmanian crap circle mystery was solved when it was discovered that wallabies were eating poppy plants, getting high, and then hopping around in circles is science.
I'm pretty sure we talked about this on the show. How am I the only one that remembers
no, we did.
This?
We did. We talked about it.
Did anybody take a picture of it? What year did it
yeah.
happen?
Yeah,
a couple years
recently.
Ago.
About 3 years ago.
Yeah.
Did it look like a crap circle?
It was a circle. Yes. Yeah, it was
yeah.
pretty good.
Yeah.
It wasn't like a well-crafted with the things. It was a circle, you know.
Yeah. I'm positive we talked about this.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
We did talk about it.
Were there emus hiding in it?
How long did it last for? Like, was it...
You know, a couple of years or something. Yeah.
They were high for 2 years?
No, the phenomenon.
Koalas are high their whole lives.
It's one hell of a party, man. Yeah.
They grow, if you're interested, they grow the poppies for medical grade, you know, pharmaceutical.
Oh, sure.
For
yeah, it's all medicine.
Yeah, it's all legit. All yeah, it's all good.
That's awesome. Okay. You win again.
Well, I was
job.
Worried.
Right,
I was
Steve.
Worried.
Good
I had
job.
No idea how easy or hard these were.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, Vince, did you know this? Did you know?
No.
You got it wrong.
No.
Well.
So, Vincent, don't feel
don't
bad.
Don't blame me. I said it was between those two. Come on.
No, no, no. I get a low hit when I listen to you guys anyway, so it's all good.
All right,
it's
all
excellent.
Good.
I'm just proud.
Was it everything you dreamed of?
Much more terrifying than that.
Okay, excellent. All right.
So, Steve, question. So, is this science or fiction number one for next year? So
this
still
counts
this year.
For this year. Yeah.
All right, okay.
Right.
Vincent, thank you so
no,
much.
Thanks,
we really
thanks,
appreciate
thank
it.
Thanks,
Gulliver, ladies and gentlemen.
Before Jay closes us out with a quote, and then I end the show, I just wanted to say we really have had a fabulous time in Australia. We really have. You guys have been awesome hosts. We do want to thank everybody. We'd love to come back anytime. Next week,
we'll
you got
there.
It. All right, Jay, close us out with a quote.
Okay. Everyone here knows who Tim Minchin is. It's a wonderful quote by Tim. Isn't this enough, just this world, just this beautiful, complex, wonderfully unfathomable world? How does it so fail to hold our attention that we have to diminish it with the invention of cheap, man-made myths and monsters?
Tim Minchin!
Thank you, George. Thanks, everyone, for joining
you.
Me this week.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.